This is Liz Lavender interviewing Orica Zaz. You are a director of multiple no-fit state shows. Can you tell me how you first found out about no-fit state and worked with no-fit state?
I was working on a performance project in Bryn Mawr. I was working with Alison Woods, who was the director of the Boiler House project. It was a project to convert a Grade 2 listed building into an arts centre in Bryn Mawr. And she invited me to develop a performance there, which I did in 1996. It was in the top floor of the Griffin Hotel in the centre of Bryn Mawr, and it was created in a week. It's somewhere else in Bryn Mawr, as part of the same project, were some people who were involved with No Fit State Circus. They were working on a community play in a hall somewhere else. And so I met Tim Hudson, I met Paul McGuinness, and I met Riley. But really the deal was this, that the project that I was working on didn't have very much budget attached to it. And Tim Hudson and his crew were promised, when they finished their work, to come and help with our project by Alison. So we met each other like that, and then they introduced me to other members of the circus. So I started going out with Tim Hudson after that, you might remember.
Yeah.
And he introduced me to the other circus crowd, and then we began a conversation about the Stepping Stones trilogy. So they knew they were going to be doing a big community project in a warehouse in the winter of 1997. So I guess that sometime in late 96 or early 97, we began a conversation about whether I might be the director of that project, which was conceived of as the first part of a trilogy. But I'm not sure if we knew about the whole trilogy then. I think perhaps we only had money to do the first one. So that was how I came to meet the company in the first place, with a focus on this really ambitious warehouse show. So the company had done
Altogether,
which Forenza had directed. So that was in 95, I think, 1995. And I met the company after that.
So I remember those that prophecy show, and that was the first kind of thing that you did. And I can't remember how the funding for that happened. Maybe you can, because you said it was a trilogy. But was there money for Prophecy, and then on the back of that there was money for the following two shows and
no,
the tent
I think
and everything?
We applied,
it was a whole three
I think
thing.
We applied for them all separately. So I think the company had secured money for Prophecy.
Right.
And then we applied the next year to do Now Here. And then we cooked up, the idea was cooked up for the tent. We became a kind of development group in that period. So there was Ali and Tom and Tim Hudson and I, and Alison at some point must have been chair of the board, so she was sort of involved and not involved some of the time.
I think that was still Tom Wiersma.
No, no,
because that
was still Tom Wiersma, that's right.
Yeah. So, the first job that you did with No Fit State, actually, I'm just going to backtrack a bit there. Had you seen any of the Blue Tent shows before all this Stepping Stones project came in? Did you see any of No Fit State's early work? Can you remember?
I saw Alice because that was touring in the summer of, must have been 96, I think, because that's just after I met Tim and everybody and I came to meet the circus. So I saw Alice.
Right.
I do think that was in 96. And then in 97, it must have been Treasure Island.
Something
and I like remember that. Coming to see that as well. And I remember that Sean Donohoe, who was then became the designer for the Stepping Stone trilogy shows, that he had designed the costumes and the set for Treasure Island. So
yeah.
I came to meet him for the first time.
Right.
In that context.
So you had seen some of the shows, the early shows, Alice and Treasure, but then you came to work on what?
So I came to work on Prophecy, or the show that became called Prophecy. So we knew it was that the theme was the past. We knew that it would take place in a warehouse in the winter. There was a desire to involve the local community and other groups. And we invented a process for how we would do that, how we would invite those groups to collaborate, to develop their own material, and how we'd create the show in response to the material that they'd created.
Your experiences of that first show, Prophecy, the good, the bad and the ugly. Give me an example of each to do with Prophecy. What was a great aspect, a bad aspect and an ugly aspect of it?
So the good aspect was being able to create these huge images. So the one that's in my mind at the moment is Frank Rosler Green, who played a character kind of based on Nostradamus, prophesizing in French with his voice amplified over a sort of, you know, some prop that suggested, you know, prophesizing. I can't remember
the oracle. The oracle.
Well, it was one of the oracles. There were lots of different oracles. And it was so huge, the drama of it and the music and the space. And it was opera scale of storytelling and emotion and drama. And for me, that was completely thrilling. To have those emotions on this scale and all this stuff going on. I was just like pig in shit. So that was brilliant for me. Really loved that. What did you say? The highlight, the low light?
The good, the bad. What was, you know, what didn't work with that show?
Well, what didn't work was that some of the groups, we involved all sorts of different groups, and some of them we were able to integrate more than others. Sorry, I've got to throw in some more highlights. So another highlight was there were two groups we worked with that I really remember and have talked about ever since. One was the battle reenactors.
Yes.
I remember that we met them. Rhianne Hutchings and I went up to that hill behind Cardiff on a Sunday morning, 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning, where we'd been invited to go and visit them. And in a clearing in the woods on the hill, did we discover a group of people with medieval weapons bashing the hell out of each other, basically. And they all had, what I remember is, as we arrived, one of the organising blokes staggered out from the other fighting people towards us with a massive cut across his head, bleeding profusely.
A real one.
And you're finished, I can't see my face. We were just totally shocked. And we discovered that they don't choreograph their fights.
Gosh.
They just, everyone gets a weapon. They decide who's who. So who's a peasant and who's a nobleman and who's... And then they get the weapon that goes with that person. And then they go into two teams and they run at each other and they just fight.
Blimey.
That's how they do it. Obviously, they don't mean to hurt each other and it's meant to be playful, but people get hurt. He wasn't bothered by this massive gash across his head pouring with blood at all. It was just like part of his normal Sunday afternoon. So that was a real highlight. There was another moment where... one of the other organisers of the Battle Reenactors came to the warehouse that we were in late at night, and he was wearing a horn across, on a string across his body.
Yeah.
And Rhianne and I asked him what the horn was for, and he said, "If I am in trouble, I will blow it and other warriors will come to my rescue." I think it's good to notice, you know, you mentioned about Tom and his interactive arts course. Mm. So the point was also that we wanted to transform those warehouse sort of spaces into theatrical installation environments. Mm. So the audience would come and there'd be art, there'd be stuff, there'd be a world to investigate and explore when they first arrived. And that would then transform to be the set for the show that was more like a show. And so Tom... invited some of the people, he was still doing that course at that time, he invited some of his fellow students to come, and they made these installations in the warehouse. And there's one that I have a photo of, Tom's got the photos, I've just got the same ones as him, of this giant spiral where you walked round this spiral of suspended fabric, and at the centre was a kind of oracle pool, a pool of water with projections on it. And when you put your hand in the water, then it changed the projection. So there was a trigger. It was all that trigger stuff that was totally high tech, and now you can buy it all from Maplin's for 20p.
That's right, yeah.
But then we all thought it was the bee's knees.
I've recently looked at a bit of video of that was shot around those times, and how delighted Tom was with these, I don't know, great big computers that were doing something very simple, but it was such a revolutionary new thing at that point in time. But it just looks so dated now, 20 years on, but it was really innovative at that point, I think, what all those installations.
Yeah.
Installation art was having a bit of a moment, wasn't it, I think?
I don't know. I mean, I think that we referred to the term installation, and that wasn't, it wasn't the same meaning as in an art world context. But that the notion of interactive technologies and the ability of people to be able to trigger things to happen in their environment, that was very new and very exciting. And Newport was one of only two or three courses in the country that did that.
So that was quite an important thing, really, but the proximity of that course, of that university, that Tom went on that course, got inspired by stuff that was being created there, and then incorporated that into a show, because that kind of idea still runs now, doesn't it, in a way? There's an immersive environment when you go into a the tented show anyway.
Definitely, yeah. So that feel of an environment and a world that's activated before you arrive, and that has a that you have a relation to, so you're an active participant, those are the essential, that's the essence of what we were all interested then, and that the company is still interested in now. Definitely.
So
some of those technologies, sorry, the specific interest in technology and the application of interactive technologies, or once we moved beyond prophecy into now here, we were very innovative with the use of video projection and mixing recorded video material with live camera footage that was shot live and edited live in front of the audience. And we did some mixing that, if you look at it now and now here, that remains something that we could all feel really proud of. It doesn't look dated. It looks like, wow, did we really do that with a couple of paper clips and a weird thing that guy John Vaughan was, no, what was his name, John, we had a bloke who made things in his shed who operated for us, John Thorne.
Okay.
Anyway, we were, you know, that stuff then, I found and continue to find that really exciting, the work that we did with video and projection then, and that didn't transfer into the tent. It was my understanding that Tom continued to be interested in it. It didn't, wasn't really part of what Forenza was interested in, and so it doesn't live there anymore.
Although it did, because there was that wonderful water screen that on Immortal 2.
That's right, Tom created that water screen for Immortal Zero in the tent. Mm. So that was still part of Tom. So Tom made that water screen for the end of the part three of the Stepping Stones trilogy, and then they reused it, that's right, in the very first Immortal.
And that was cool, I think. And then after that, what was the next one? Taboo, wasn't there something in a kind of water cage in that one? So that kind of thought, I'm sure there was something, wasn't Sage in a...
I don't think it was Sage, but there was... I know what you mean, they had a thing in
Vanina.
The shower. Yeah, Natalia or Benina or somebody in a shower with water. Yeah, the water carriage on, definitely.
Yeah, the water and the projection and the person sort of hidden behind it, slightly visible.
I'm going to have to stop, Liz.
Okay, just one very quick one. I'm going to have to come back to you because there's a lot more to discuss. Sorry, don't look so sad.
No, I don't. It's really weird to think about it all again and think, God, I can't really remember anything.
And we've only got as far as prophecy. And actually, you know, there's a lot of stuff that, you know, what show have you enjoyed directing the most? Which show is your favourite show out of all the shows that you've directed?
Oh, I don't think I can answer that.
No.
I think that what I've absolutely loved about the work that I've done with No Fit State Circus is that each show has been a huge adventure. that we've embarked on trying to do something that none of us have ever done before, and that required for me my journey, my career journey, it needed all the other things that I'd ever done to come together in this moment to do this. And I think for all of us, that's when work and life is most satisfying, when all the weird disparate stuff that you've ever done or interested yourself in, all of it was needed. You needed to do it all so that you could do this thing now. And I feel that that's the opportunity that we've had together, and that No Fits Day has offered me as a creative being, is the opportunity to bring together all the things that I've ever experienced and bring them to bear in a kind of blank slate of huge ambition.
That's lovely. That is a wonderful description. And I don't blame you for not being able to choose one show, because they all have their merits and everything. And I'd be really interested to talk to you about Park Life. No.
We've got loads.
This one, Open House, the one that's out there now, that you're doing at the moment.
There's also the chair, there's also the board years. So I don't know if you want to go into any of that.
You were on the board as well, weren't you? You were chair of the board after Tom and before this new...
No, Tom, Alison, after Alison and before Paul.
Right, OK. Well, yeah, we will in that case. I'd forgotten about that aspect of your relationship.
Yeah, I've changed my part loads of times.
Shall we call it a day now?
Yeah, thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you very much.